This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. From the surface of the planet Earth, we head to Boca Chica, Texas, the day after the event. Bob Zimmerman is here. He keeps the website Behind the Black. Bob, I assert that I hear repeatedly now in media from the informed that the first test of Starship on Super Heavy was a success. Do you agree? And why success, Bob? It's said to have failed. Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Yeah, well, this was probably the most successful failure I've seen in a very, very long time. I should say that a lot of uninformed media outlets have in their headlines, Starship Super Heavy exploded. It did not explode. It did not explode. What happened was it launched, cleared the launch tower. Super Heavy functioned remarkably well for its very first attempt, very first time. They fired the engines on this thing for an extended period to lift off, and it reached the point when they're supposed to do stage separation, engine cut off, and then stage separation. Starship would then fly on its own, ignite its engines, and head up to orbit. But it did not separate as planned. And it appears that Super Heavy, with the two still connected, attempted to do its flip, whereby it would reposition itself to return back to the ground, but it still had Starship attached. And so the thing began to tumble. It was very clearly struggling to right itself because it had had extra weight on it. And after a period of time, and the it's very clear the engineers at SpaceX, in conjunction with the range, waited a long time before they initiated the flight termination system, which is the self-destruct button. And the reason they waited was probably twofold. One, they wanted to make sure the thing was far enough out to sea and clear of the way of land so that when they did self-destruct, any debris that hit the ground would hit the water and not hurt anybody. And secondly, the longer they wait, the more data they collect, which is the whole point of this This launch, hoping to get to orbit, was an engineering test of two prototypes to see if what they've designed so far has any merit. And it very clearly now has merit. It works. It has issues. For example, a lot of the 33 engines, anywhere from 5 to 8 engines on Super Heavy conked out during the launch period. Why that happened, there's a lot of theories. We don't know. They're going to have to analyze it. I suspect one of the factors, and I'm not an engineer, is that you've never had this many engines so tightly packed together, so powerful. These are very powerful engines, most powerful ever made. And there's likely resonances and vibrations going on when they fire, and it could actually be conking out some engines. There's also a great deal of damage to the concrete below the launch pad, a great deal of damage, so much so that it's questionable whether that tower is safe right now. They did not put in what they call a flame trench to guide the flames away, and so it just destroyed the concrete that was below, and that some of that concrete pieces might have come up and hit the engines during the launch period. And so they have to now look at all this data and try to figure it out. SpaceX says it could launch in a couple of months. That ain't going to happen, and it ain't going to happen not because of SpaceX. It ain't going to happen because the FAA has already announced it's grounding all Starship launches because of this accident. They want to put together an accident commission. This is an engineering test. There's no question an accident. This was going to happen. Something like this could happen. It was expected by SpaceX. To treat this like an airline accident is, of course, the federal government moving in, power grab, and probably some people hostile in the Biden administration and the bureaucracy, hostile to Elon Musk, and trying to squelch what he's doing.
But it's your opinion it is a success. Is that correct, Bob?
Without any question, it's a success. An engineering test like this, They had no doubt that this thing was, that they knew the odds of this reaching orbit successfully and Starship then landing was low. But you fire the rocket and you test it to see what you don't have right. Remember, these are prototypes. These are not even the most advanced prototypes. I read one comment where Elon Musk probably said go because they might as well test this prototype, find out what's wrong with it, and then put changes into the later prototypes. These are older prototypes.
Right.
They've already come up with better engines.
This was Starship 24 and Booster 7. They're more in the assembly line, yes.
That's correct. So you know, you fire them, you lose them because you want to move on to better prototypes. So that they had to self-destruct is not a failure. It means they had a very successful Super Heavy test.
Good.
They got almost to say, really, it's remarkable to me that having never fired this many Raptor 2 engines and a Super Heavy at one time, they not only fire them, they lift off and the thing gets to stage separation and had almost a nominal appearing launch trajectory with engines out, which means the other engines were compensating for the loss of power. This is a remarkable success for a first launch. And once again, you don't have a National Safety Board investigation for such a something like this. They didn't do it with any other rocket launches like Fireflies or Relativities or Astra's failures. You wouldn't do that. You let them do an acoustic investigation and fire again. But no, the federal government's putting it in and shutting them down.
Commercial space continues. Rocket Lab is going to use a flown engine. What's the significance of that, Bob?
They are one of the only two companies, SpaceX is the other, that really is aggressively working for reusability as they operate. Rocket Lab has its rocket called the Electron rocket. It's a small sat rocket. It's not as big as anything SpaceX got, but they've been launching it successfully and making money. And so they've been also trying to see if they could reuse the first stage. And they thought they were going to drop it with parachutes and then catch the parachute with a helicopter and drop it on land. They've now abandoned the helicopter entirely. They found that they can recover out of the ocean, the first stage, quickly enough that the engines don't get damaged by the salt water. And in fact, they've now tested an engine that had flown in 22 sufficiently to make them confident they can put it on a rocket and use it again, and that's what they're going to do. So sometime in the third quarter of this year, that pre-flown Rutherford engine will be on a first stage of a Rocket Lab rocket, and it will fly again. And their goal is eventually to be able to recover cover the entire stage and just fly the stage as is. And they're moving in that direction.
In other words, they're going to recover first stage booster, or do they just have one stage?
No, they have a first and a second stage. Well, you have to have multiple stages. In the first stage, they're trying to see if they can recover it like SpaceX does and reuse it, and they're moving closer to that.
So that becomes the model. We've noted that other space organizations are paying attention to the recovery, and notably China. Bob, for everybody to remember, the original concept of recovering a booster, I believe my memory says, NASA talked about it back in the middle of the 20th century. Why did they drop that, Bob, recovery?
Well, actually, I don't think NASA ever talked about it very much. In fact, every manager of every rocket company and engineer, practically, that I ever talked to for decades said that this was impossible. You could not vertically land a first stage and then reuse it. And even if you wanted to and did, you wouldn't have enough fuel to get your payloads into orbit because you'd be using so much to land. So this is no point trying, and they never did. They never did. The closest NASA ever came to trying to do something kind of like this was the shuttle. And in the original concepts, it would have been two shuttles launched back-to-back, with the one shuttle as the first stage and the second shuttle going into orbit, and both would then land on a runway and be reused. They never did that because of political reasons. But other than that, nobody ever considered landing a first stage until Elon Musk came along and said, we can do it.
And that's how you save money. I note that it's a $2 billion estimate for an SLS launch, and it's a $40 million launch for a Super Heavy Starship. Compare and contrast. Axiom. What is Axiom, Bob?
Axiom is the private commercial company that has already flown one commercial mission to ISS with passengers. They used the Dragon capsule and Falcon 9 rocket. They are building modules to attach to ISS that would eventually, once enough of them are assembled, would detach from ISS and become an independent space station. Well, Axiom has now announced a set of package space program deals for other countries. Three different possible deals. They've already got deals with New Zealand and Uzbekistan and Azerbaijan and New Zealand. I think Turkey and Hungary as well, though not mentioned. They're going to fly an Italian astronaut on their third mission to ISS. They're about to fly two astronauts from Saudi Arabia ISS in May. Well, this three-part tiered program, the first, they would give countries advice and insight and give those kind of, you know, pay a consulting fee, essentially. The second tier, they would allow them to do research and development activities on their modules or space stations. And the third is what they've done with the Italian and the Saudi Arabians, is they launch astronauts on a regular basis for any nation that wishes it. And there's a fourth tier called developing sections of Axiom Station. In other words, another country could help pay for and build one of Axiom's modules. They get their own room in space, essentially. But basically, they're taking advantage of government. And the company says that it's found its customers divide into three components: government, private citizens, and corporations. That's presently the order in market share, but they expect corporations to eventually be the biggest customer.
I've visited with the Azerbaijan space efforts. They have a couple of satellites up now, and they lease time on their satellites. It's a moneymaker for them. So what we're looking at is a series of smaller governments participating in commercial space. Even though these are governments, we're looking at prosperity and also training young people to participate globally. It's all extremely positive given where we're headed. Now we go to India. India's Modi government and their policy, Bob, please describe.
This is a big deal in my mind. The Modi government in India has been hinting at a new space policy. Now, past space policies from the Indian government have been extremely oppressive to commercial space. They're basically the bureaucracy that wants to maintain control over everything. And I should point out that that bureaucracy, the ISRO, their space agency, basically builds and constructs everything, designs everything, and then markets it on the international market for commercial launches, trying to make money. So they basically act like a private company as a government agency. Well, the Modi government's announced new space policy. It's actually unlike any government document from India I've ever seen, because it was short, it was direct, it was clearly written and to the point. No jargon, no bureaucratic blather, which is routine from India, but this didn't have it. Very, very to the point. It essentially adopts the recommendations I put forth in 2017 in my Capitalism in Space policy paper. It takes all control away from ISRO. It gives supervisory control to two new space agencies, one of which whose goal is to, quote, ensure a level playing field for the utilization of all facilities created using public expenditure by prioritizing their use among government entities and private companies. In other words, they're supposed to allow any facilities, government facilities that exist, like launch pads, to be used by anybody equally. Secondly, these agencies are supposed to facilitate private companies from growing, basically, like NASA's been doing it for the last decade. There are issues here. One of those agencies, called INSEL, is going to essentially take over the commercial business that ISRO had been running. So they are going to be a competitor with the private enterprise, but they'll be a government agency. So there's, you know, the bureaucracy in India is very strong, and you have a turf war going on between private enterprise and government. And so this is only a step forward. It's not a victory yet. But it does appear the Modi government wants to emulate what NASA has done in the last decade, transition its space program to transition from being the builder and designer of everything and controlling everything to being a customer that merely buys what it needs from the private sector.
Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. We're going exploring next to the surface of our sun. There's news. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.